The engines are on. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
This is the SF Signal Podcast. My name is Patrick Hester. I am your host. I'm an author, a blogger, a podcast dude, and recently won a Hugo Award for fanzine. Yay! But yeah, I digress. But you know, I never get tired of telling people that. So tonight we are meeting with some authors and editors who are actually putting together some different Kickstarter projects, and we thought it'd be fun to get everybody together and talk about it. I'm going to go down the line and introduce everybody. I'm going to do ladies first. So Mary Robinette Kowal is the author of Shades of Milk and Honey, which is out from Tor in 2010, and Glamour and Glass, which was from Tor in 2012. In 2008, she received the Campbell Award for Best New Writer, and in 2011, her short story For Want of a Nail won the Hugo Award for Short Story. Her work has been nominated for the Hugo, Nebula, and Locus Awards. Her stories appear in Asimov's Clark's World and several Year's Best Anthologies. Mary, a professional puppeteer, also performs as a voice actor, recording fiction for authors such as Elizabeth Baer, Cory Doctorow, and John Scalzi. She lives in Chicago with her husband, Rob, and over a dozen manual typewriters. Really, a dozen?
We have 17 right now, actually.
Oh my gosh. I saw the coolest one at Mile High Con last year. I took pictures of it. I should send it to you. It was very,
you should.
Very neat. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Well, thanks for coming on tonight. We appreciate it.
Thanks for hosting us. I'm looking forward to this.
Have you recovered fully from Worldcon?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Worldcon seems like a very long time ago. I've been kind of busy since then. So recovered from Worldcon, recovered from the rest of travel, maybe not.
I was sick as a dog for a week.
Oh, I'm lucky I rarely get con crud. It's, I think after years of touring to elementary schools with the puppetry, I have the immune system of the gods.
Yes, you do. That's awesome. Next up, we have John Joseph Adams, who has been called the reigning king of the anthology world because he puts out, I believe, 17 a month now. And he's the best-selling editor of many anthologies, such as Oz Reimagined, The Mad Scientist's Guide to World Domination, Epic Legends of Fantasy, Other Worlds Than These, Armored, Under the Moons of Mars, Brave New Worlds, Wastelands, The Living Dead, Federations, The Improbable Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, which is one of my favorites, and The Way of the Wizard. He is a 6-time finalist for the Hugo Award and a 5-time nominee for the World Fantasy Award. He is also editor and publisher of the magazine Lightspeed and Nightmare, and is the co-host of Wired.com's The Geek's Guide to the Galaxy podcast. You can find him on Twitter at John Joseph Adams, or you can listen to him tonight here on the podcast. Hi, John.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
And you and I, we were ships passing in the night at Worldcon.
Yes, sadly.
I think the only time I actually saw you, I saw you twice. Once you were on your way to the restroom, and it was very, very brief hello.
Right. You got a picture, though.
I did.
Not in the restroom, but no.
No, that, well, we weren't going to talk about that one.
I'm sure that picture made everyone jealous, though, and it looked like we were best buds and we hung out the whole con.
Yes, I know. And then the only other time we saw each other was at the Hugo ceremony, the pre-ceremony show thing.
Yep.
Did you know that it started an hour earlier than the paper said?
I did discover that beforehand, and unfortunately, there was no way to really get the word out. I thought we ran into John DiNardo and told him, but that may have been when it was still up in the air and we weren't sure what the status actually was. But yeah, we heard late that it was actually an hour earlier than it said, and we managed to get there on time. But did you not get there until late?
No, I was there an hour late because I thought, and John, being John, he thought that I knew, and I didn't. He's like, well, you were there. No, I wasn't. Oh, well, I thought you were. So anyway, yeah.
I think he did it on purpose.
He probably did. Yeah, he's that way. He's like, no, the Hugo's for me.
Actually, I suspect the con may have done the whole thing on purpose just to make you be an hour late.
No, the con has no clue who I am. Next up, we're going to say hello to Matt Forbeck. Matt Forbeck has worked full-time on games and fiction. Now, Matt, I hobbled this together from stuff on your website, so if there's anything extra you want to throw in, please do. Matt Forbeck has worked full-time on games and fiction since 1989, when he graduated from the Residential College at the University of Michigan with a degree in creative writing. With the exception of a 4-year stint as the president of Pinnacle Entertainment Group and 2 years as director director of the Adventure Games Division at Human Head Studios. He freelanced exclusively through that time. Matt has designed collectible card games, role-playing games, miniature games, board games, and logic systems for toys, and has directed voiceover work and written short fiction, comic books, novels, screenplays, and computer game scripts and stories. His work has been translated into a ton of languages that I'm not going to list. And if John is the anthology king, I would say that Forbeck is the Kickstarter king.
That's a good title. I'll claim that.
Yeah. Because you've got it down to a science, and you and I even emailed about this recently because you've got some great stuff on your website about, you know, how to do a Kickstarter right.
Yeah, well, it's all hard-won knowledge, mostly by banging my head against walls, but I figure I could save people the problem. They can get bruises in other parts of their heads than I did, at least.
Exactly. Well, we appreciate you doing all the hard work so that we can just ride your coattails.
Well, it's okay with me. It's good. It's good to have people riding along.
This next bio is super short, Tobias, or Toby. What do you prefer? Do you prefer Toby or Tobias?
It doesn't matter to me.
Okay. Mr. Bakel. So, you and I met a couple years back at World Fantasy. I think you're an awesome guy, but you need a new bio. So Tobias Bakel was born in the Caribbean and lived on a yacht until he moved to the U.S. He writes science fiction. His latest novel, is it still Arctic Rising? Or what's your latest novel?
Arctic Rising is the last one that came out from Tor. Okay. And the last one that came out from me was The Apocalypse Ocean.
The Apocalypse. Okay, that's what I thought. And he lives online at TobiasBakel.com. And you can also find him at Twitter at Tobias Bakel, if I'm not mistaken. It is Tobias Bakel at Twitter.
Yep, that is... Okay. That is correct.
So now that I've awkwardly done that... Yeah, now that I've awkwardly done all that... By the way, John DiNardo listens to this and he cringes. He absolutely cringes.
I'm cringing right now.
Yeah, I know. It's horrible. Toby, how are you?
I'm all right.
I did get to see you slightly longer than I saw John, but again, it was just, you know, ships passing in the night at Worldcon.
Sure. Yeah, well, I mean, that's the hard thing at a major convention is that, particularly what one as big as Worldcon, is that everyone ends up being ships passing in the night. I mean, it's just really hard to sit down and have very long, in-depth conversations when there are just so many people that you might know passing by. It's perfect for someone who's ADD like me, though.
Me too, yeah. And then, but do you ever feel like bad, like when you turn to say hello to somebody else and the person you're talking to is kind of sitting there waiting?
You know, I've worked really hard at actually, over the last few years in particular, at trying not to just leave everyone hanging. I used to go and just be sort of like a rabid weasel just running around, just going like, conversation, people, shiny, just because that's in my nature. And I've actually made a real strong commitment to sit there and let a conversation sort of reach its natural endpoint before I move on. Or if it's somebody that I've already kind of made arrangements with to see, you know, then I go kind of like, I'm really sorry, but, you know, I plan to meet this person. I'm going to boogie.
Well, you talk about ships in the night and all that kind of good stuff and having a good conversation. What I've discovered at Worldcon and the secret to my Worldcon happiness is I don't sit in the bar because it's too loud and you can't actually have a conversation. I sit in a comfortable chair between the bar and the restroom. Because eventually I will.
Hear it, yeah.
Yes, eventually I will get to see everybody.
And you ambush everyone as they go by.
Exactly.
You know, one of my favorite conventions stories, moments I had was hanging out in the at a tour party that was way too hot, as they all are. So we went into the bathroom where the drinks were, you know, how they kind of fill up the tub with ice and they put all the drinks, and a few of us decamped into the bathroom because the ice was nice and cool and it was only the three of us, so we had the whole bathroom. And as people came to the door to look for drinks, we would just tell them what the selection was and ask them what they wanted and hand it to them. And that way we got to spend the whole night being able to hear each other and have kind of like a little private space of our own. But if anyone was really interested, interesting to us, showed up for drinks, we would just kind of pull them in temporarily as we got them their drink and then release them later.
That is awesome.
It's a catch-and-release program. That's the one.
It was a drinks-based bathroom catch-and-release program.
You do know the bait for writers.
Yes, you do. Yes. We just recorded something over in the Functional Nerds where we did, this guy was doing a Kickstarter. He has a web series about microbrews and microbreweries.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was beer. And Anilio said, you know, I think this is going to be perfect for our audience. I said, yeah, John, I think you've figured out something that no one else has figured out before. Authors and beer.
Yeah.
So we're here tonight to talk about Kickstarters. Why don't we do this? Matt, what's a Kickstarter?
It's something you start with a kick. now, Kickstarter is the most popular of the crowdfunding platforms that are available on the internet. What that means is it's a website on which you put up a project that you want to do. In case of Kickstarter, it's always a creative project of some sort. And then you say, I'd like to do this project, but I can't afford to do it on my own, and I need some help. And if I can raise X number of dollars, I'm going to do this project. And in order to incite these people to give you the money that you need to hit that goal of yours, you give them a schedule of rewards. It says, if you give me this much money, you get this thing. If you give me this much more money, I get you even cooler things. And if you're lucky and at the end of the whole thing, you reach your goal and maybe even get past that, then the project goes forward, everybody's credit card gets charged, and then you're off the races to make that project or product or artistic event that you're going to be doing and make everybody happy and have them all give you even more money later on when you start selling it on the internet separately.
Now, Kickstarter, you said, is one of the it's one of the more popular websites, but really it's kind of become synonymous with the whole crowdfunding thing. It's almost like, you know, Googling. Now,
yeah, it's like Coke for soda in the South, right? It's what everybody thinks of first. But there are other platforms like Indiegogo. There's Fundable. There's a bunch of other ones. They all have their own individual reasons for existing. One of the main reasons is that Kickstarter is specifically only for creative projects and can't be used, for instance, for any charitable things or for raising money for really anything except for a product that you're going to use. That's the basis of a creative effort.
Go ahead, Mary.
Well, I think the pointing out the charitable thing, they also don't allow anything that's associated with a 501c3. I think partly because they're trying to encourage projects that can't seek, you know, that there aren't other ways to get funding for. And a lot of 501c3s can go after grants.
Correct. And one of the other reasons people go with Kickstarter is because up until recently, they were only taking funds in U.S. dollars, right? And you're only allowed to run a Kickstarter if you had a U.S. bank account. Now they've opened up in the UK, and I believe just this month they're opening up in Canada. But for the rest of the world, unless they have a friend who has a bank account they have access to, they have to set up with some other kind of a program.
And that was going to be my question, because a Geeky Jules, a friend of mine in Canada, wanted to do a crowdfunding project and realized that you couldn't do it through Kickstarter if you lived in Canada at the time. And so that project went through Indiegogo.
Right, which seems to be the Diet Pepsi to the Diet Coke.
Now, have all of you done Kickstarters before?
I think so. I have.
I've done a bunch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, we all have.
So I knew that Matt and Toby had done. I didn't. Mary, what was your Kickstarter that you've done?
My Kickstarter was to take a puppet show to WorldCon.
That's right. Okay. Yes, I do remember that. How did that go?
Well, the Kickstarter went really well. We raised enough money, but I am the cautionary tale of really paying attention to how long it will take you to do fulfillment, because that was to go to the Reno Worldcon, so that would have been in 2011, and I am still doing rewards.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
And a lot of that was because I thought that I had factored in exactly how long it would take me to make things, and I did, but I didn't factor in what my schedule was like in terms of moving cross country or suddenly having a lot more book tour and audiobook work than I had previously had. So, you know, I am the cautionary tale of really think about things before you say, I'm going to handcraft 6 weasels.
And so now, Matt, you've done books because you did the 12 months.
Yeah, that was what I had decided. I wanted to do 12 books in 2012, 50,000 words each, short novels. And I broke them up into 4 different trilogies and ran a Kickstarter for each of those trilogies. And they each did very well. They all overfunded. I'm still in the process of delivering the last 3 of those. But the first 9 have gone very well. That year, I didn't quite write 12 novels. I wrote 10 novels, including a leverage tie-in, and 9 comic book scripts and a StarCraft short story and a bunch of other stuff.
Oh, is that all?
I failed well, at least, right?
and have you run into the kind of issues that Mary was talking about with like the rewards?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it takes longer than you think. There are other things that really crop up in your time. For instance, just running a Kickstarter takes like every spare second of your day during the month or so that you're running the Kickstarter, all of your brain power that you haven't got dedicated to something else goes directly to that Kickstarter. It just gets drawn over to it like it's a black hole. And that takes up a lot of your time. Other things I did is I promised things like signing all of the ebooks, which I found a great app called MyWrite that allows you to sign ebooks and send them to people. But when you've got 400 or 500 ebooks to sign, that can take you a day or two, right?
Wow. Oof.
So it's a good problem to have, mind you, but still it's an issue. And just, you know, getting all the fulfillment and everything else set up took me a little bit of a while. But once you do it the first time, it becomes easier because you make fewer mistakes as you go on the second, third, and fourth times.
Now, Toby,
yeah, I would say that the also the first couple of months right before your Kickstarter launches is also very consumed with thoughts of the Kickstarter and figuring out all the different things, and then also probably the month or two after, like depending on what your rewards are and how you're fulfilling them, you know, a lot of that is you know, a lot of your time is sucked up doing that too. So it's not just like the 1 month that that you have to worry about. It's like, you know, it's a good span of time.
And John, I was going to come to you.
Yeah, it sucks up your entire life as much as it possibly can.
But yeah. since you jumped in, I'm curious, John. Now you kickstarted Nightmare.
Uh huh. Yep.
How did that go? Yeah.
Well, that went very well. It funded a little bit over our goal. We didn't like super fund or anything, but you know, we met our goal, and yeah, I mean, it did exactly what we wanted it to. I mean, we wanted to raise some capital before we launched the magazine, and we were able to do that. So that way, when we actually published our first issue, we already had a good number of subscribers. We didn't have to worry about finding our subscribers after we launched. As soon as we published that first issue, we hit the ground running. So. Yeah, I mean, I was very happy with how it went. And, you know, the thing is, since it was in a digital magazine, we didn't really have to worry too much about our various rewards and stuff because almost all of our rewards were actually digital. So they were very easy to distribute. And, you know, we sold subscriptions and that kind of thing. And so, you know, we had the subscriptions entered into our system after we concluded the Kickstarter. And then we sent out individual ebook issues that people bought and that kind of thing. So we did have a couple of things that were book prizes because I was partnered with Creeping Hemlock Press. And we had a couple Creeping Hemlock related prizes. But my partners had to deal with that, not me. But, you know, so.
What was your goal, John?
Let's see. I think my goal was 7,500 or so. And then we raised about 9,000, I want to say. I can look it up real quick.
That's okay. And Mary, what was your goal for Reno?
I think it was, I can't remember now if it was 3,000 and we raised 5 or if it was 5 and we raised 6. I think it was 3 and we raised 5.
And
sorry,
Matt,
it has unfortunately been a couple of years.
That's okay. And Matt, were you doing each individual book or did you do the whole project as a whole?
You know, the first, I broke them up into 4 trilogies, like I
That's
said.
That's what
before.
I thought.
And, but the first one I decided I was going to set it up as doing one book for $3,000 the first book, and then doing the next 2 books in the trilogy as stretch goals, right? Mm-hmm. And by the time I did the second one, I realized that was actually hurting me because people were going, geez, I don't want to really back this if I have to worry about whether or not he's going to hit these stretch goals. So by the time I got to the third one, I just said, it's going to be 10 grand for all 3 novels, and let's see how far we can push it past that. At the end of the day, when we did all 4 of them, I ended up with about $60,000.
Now, Toby, you kickstarted a novel.
Yes, I did.
And that's the Apocalypse Ocean.
That's the Apocalypse Ocean. It was the 4th book in a series I've been doing. The first 3 were out from Toru, Crystal Rain, Ragamuffin, mm-hmm. and Sly Mongoose. We kind of discontinued that series because the sales were flat. They weren't declining, but they weren't taking off. So we decided, you know, mutually to try to do the novel that became Arctic Rising. But a lot of people were emailing me, when are you going to continue the series? Because I've talked about the fact that I have 2 more books planned in it. And, you know, I decided to sort of put it out there and try a Kickstarter and see what we could get out of that. And whether or not there was enough demand there to kind of feed doing a Kickstarter. I set the goal for 10 grand, you know, because I wanted it to be something that was in line with what people, you know, a sort of low mid-list writer would get for a novel in this day and age. And, you know, I get a little bit more than that when I go with traditional publishing, quote unquote traditional publishing, but I wanted something that would at least get into that 5-figure range because I wasn't sure how much it would cost to print them. I wasn't sure what all the different pieces would be. So I wanted a good margin so I wasn't hurting myself. And I also needed, you know, the time to definitely throw down and do this novel right. So I just wanted to make sure all the pieces were there. We ended up raising about $12,500. After the Kickstarter shut down, there were some other people who kept approaching me using PayPal. So we got $12,500 when it all was said and done.
Now, what's interesting is you said you set your goal at $10,000 because you didn't know how much it was going to cost. Matt, on the other hand, if you go to his blog, he has like detailed stuff talking about, you know, he figured everything out.
I figured everything out, but you still don't know what it's going to cost. I mean, in other words, what I mean is, like, you can play lots of scenarios, which is what, you know, Matt did on his website, but you just don't know. I mean, I have an Excel spreadsheet which has every different scenario mapped out as I was coming up with the Kickstarter. There are all sorts of intangibles in there that, like,
sure.
You know, I had, I know, Matt, you used a print-on-demand publisher, but I wanted to use offset print, right? And that cost can vary quite a bit. So I ended up using a offset printer in that does a lot of collectible books. So the print quality was really nice.
Are they in Memphis? And
no, they're not.
Okay,
they're not. They're in Michigan. But they did a beautiful job on the book itself and the quality of the paper and everything like that. It's collectible, and you know those sorts of things. You don't know how much that's going to cost until you can call them up and tell them how many copies you need printed, and you don't know how many copies you're going to need printed until the very end of it. You know, and so there are just lots of variables, and you know, I did not want to end up in this area where I got, you know, a $5,000 sort of project and it was going to cost me $6,000 to do in terms of my time and everything like that. So I just wanted to make sure we went in with the right amount.
And that's something that you have to watch out anytime you're doing any sort of freelance project, which is really what Kickstarter is. I mean, you're creating a freelance project where you have lots of different bosses, not different bosses, but where the funding is coming from a lot of different people. But anytime you're doing something like this, you have to make sure that if you cannot do it yourself, that you are setting the price so that you can hire someone and still make a profit. When we're doing puppetry, when we're doing puppetry, the standard rule of thumb is you make an estimate of how long you think it's going to take you to do. And then you double it because something always goes wrong. Mm-hmm. And then you add a 20% administration fee into that, because if you have to hire someone else to do it, then that 20% is your take home. Otherwise, you're not making any money and you're still having to do work.
and that's a good rule of thumb no matter what you're doing freelance. Because a friend of mine, one of my best friends here in Denver, he's a software developer. And the thing that bugs me the most about him is that he always underbids his projects. And then he underbids them and then he stresses because he's overworking or he didn't pad it enough with the number. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, that seems to be a huge problem with a lot of people who decide to go into freelance projects.
They
don't give themselves enough padding.
Right. And that was one of the mistakes that I made with mine, even though I totally know better because I've spent 20 years, you know, supporting myself as a puppeteer. I wanted to make sure that we got there. And I thought that I had padded in enough time, that I had padded in enough to account for everything. But then there are always unexpected costs. And I didn't build in enough of a buffer. And there were enough unknowns going into it, because we were moving our set and three people, and although we thought we had done all of the research, there's always something that you don't expect. And we just, you know.
Well, sure.
That's something to, when you go into doing a Kickstarter, you really have to make sure that you have done, you have researched every single piece of it.
Sure. And it was one of those reasons I had a very high amount, or what people told me was a high amount. I just sort of looked at the price and said, this is what it would take for me to devote the time and you know, a budget for printing, you know, 200 offset copies. But, you know, a lot of people approached me and said, well, why didn't you price the novel, you know, very low so that you could guarantee that you would get the lock-in? And I said, well, that's the worst case scenario is if I'd agreed to write an entire novel and create, you know, a collectible hardcover for people who funded at a certain level, at a level that was low enough that it ended up not being able to be done properly.
Mm-hmm.
Because then everyone just gets unsatisfied. Better to just not have the Kickstarter fund than to sort of end up with that sort of half and half scenario
right.
for me.
And that's exactly the point of Kickstarter, right? The whole point of Kickstarter is being able to run a business idea in front of people, up the flagpole, so to speak, and
sure.
see if anybody salutes. And if you can't get the funds lined up, it's a lot easier to have it just go to hell in 30 days on a Kickstarter than it is to do the traditional way, which is to go print the book, try to see how you can sell it, you know, schlep it around everywhere and see if you can hand sell it to everybody, and then have it fail that way, right? And often you had to go take a loan for the printing. Back when I did, when I was a game publisher, we had to do this all the time. You just had to do it on hope and a prayer and belief in yourself. And this way now you can actually say, well, let's figure out in 30 days if this is a reasonable project or a plan that I've developed here. And if not, go away. You know, it's much simpler. That way, you know, you're not blowing your parents' retirement fund. You're not double mortgaging your house. You're still welcome with your family over Thanksgiving.
Unless you talk politics. Unless you talk politics.
Well, there, yeah.
It's angel funding is what it is.
Yeah.
It really is. Now, you talk about the problems that can come up. A friend of mine, a friend of the podcast, you folks may have heard of her. She's slightly famous right now. Her name is Mer Lafferty.
Mm-hmm.
And she did a Kickstarter. And I remember editing the podcast episodes where she was talking about how one mistake and suddenly her margins on that Kickstarter are no longer very good. You know, basically, there was a printing mistake that no one caught.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Until they were already printed and sitting there, and she has to reorder the whole thing.
Yeah, with Mitigated Futures, a short story collection I did, I ate like $400 on that due to a printing error. We didn't catch it. I mean, I sold some of the printing errors directly off my website, and I think that helped a little bit, but I still think in the end it ended up costing me like $300-$350, which was an ouch.
And, yeah, on an author's salary or a freelancer's salary, that's a huge chunk.
Yeah.
Back in 2012, things were really, really lean. So that eating $500 really that actually did hurt.
Yeah. Now the other side of it is actually funding it and then being overwhelmed because you funded it. I've heard
right.
that story.
It's a good problem to have again, but it's still a problem.
Well, there's all these success stories out there about like games are a good area. All these people are doing board games and role playing games and all this kind of stuff, and they're looking for 10 grand and they get 50,
mm-hmm.
and they implode because they don't know what the hell to do with $50,000.
Make more games.
Yeah.
No, but a lot of
that comes down to paying attention to the reason if you set your Kickstarter upright, success shouldn't overwhelm you like that.
Right.
What that indicates is that they have been giving themselves stretch goals and more add-ons that cause that influx of extra money that has added to their workload to a point where it's geometrically increased. You know, for example, if you know, suppose 50,000 people had signed on to my Kickstarter for my novel, you know, most of my stretch goals were basically like we added more things to the novel, like, you know, more like we were aiming for more stuff that my graphic artist could add in. We were aiming for other stuff that like wouldn't cost me time. Is mm-hmm. what I was setting up is. The only thing that would have cost me time was shipping more hardcovers. But at that point, I had an intern that was helping me. So I basically had it set up so that like all success would do is create more money for the project and not actually more work for me. So the difference between a $10,000 and a $50,000 project wouldn't have been, you know, profoundly challenging in that direction. But some people who say like, oh, if we reach $20,000, I'm going to write another novel in this series. You know, like at that point, you need to be aware of how much effort you're bolting onto the project and when these things are going to be delivered if you have this wild success. You know, one person I noticed, Harry Connolly, just had a very successful Kickstarter recently.
It's still going on.
And one of the things I really have to raise my hat to him for is that, you know, a lot of people were like telling him, you know, on Twitter and emailing him like, you know, oh, you're successful. You're hitting these amazing funding heights. Start adding stuff. Start adding stretch goals. Mm. And he was just like, you know, whoa, 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 whoa. I'm going to sit down and think about it for 24 hours and think about what will be value added if people keep adding, you know, giving money for this project, but not things that are basically going to like get in the way, that shoot him in his own foot. And yeah, of course, what he came up was with better cover art, you know, more stuff to invest in it, but that's not more stuff that actually is going to stop him from doing the work he needs to do to deliver that project. And I think that's actually a very laudable thing.
One of the things that you have to think about is that when more people fund, that's also more product you have to deliver. So it's not just, yeah, ooh, we've got, you know, that much extra money, because you still, you know, now you're also having to print more copies and ship more copies. So that's postage and all sorts of other things. And you can't just, yeah, like the adding an extra novel, it's not like you have another $10,000, because you still have to print twice as many copies of the first novel as you had planned.
Exactly.
Or make more weasels.
Or make more weasels.
Yeah.
Yes.
Some now, very clever, yes, Kickstarter people often limit the amount of awards. Like, you see some people who say, like, we will do 500 copies of this book max, and that's it. And then from then on, it's like maybe the ebook. So they know that they'll never have to print and mail more than 500 copies, and you know, you can get more of the e-product and items like that. And that those are, there are ways to cap this, you know, if you think about it ahead of time.
Now, the literary world, the authors especially, have really embraced Kickstarter because it's giving them an opportunity to do things that maybe they wouldn't otherwise have a chance to do. So, for example, Toby was able to write another book in a series that was, as far as the publisher was concerned, over. Matt was able to put out 9 books so far. He's got 3 more on the way. John was able to do basically a proof of concept and find that, yes, there is an audience that would love to have a horror magazine out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Mary, with your puppet show, that's a little different. You know, that's something that you would have to, otherwise, I mean, how would you have put that together if it weren't for Kickstarter?
Well, otherwise, if it weren't for Kickstarter, we would not have taken the show to Worldcon. Worldcon wanted to have us, and you know, it's 3 puppeteers. It's a lot of equipment. We're expensive. When I toured professionally, we didn't even, you know, you couldn't book us for less than $1,200, and that was for a tour we were already on. Mm. So doing something, and a 2-person show at that. So doing something where we were taking an entire show to a location for one show, and then having to fly people in because it was, you know, it was a remount of a show that we had done before, we just couldn't have done it. And that's the thing I think that's exciting about Kickstarter, is projects that you can't do other ways. Like, people have asked me whether or not I would be interested in doing a Kickstarter for a novel. And at this point, I'm not yet at the point where I'm interested in doing that, because I all of the projects that I'm interested in doing so far, we've been able to place. And having watched my friends do Kickstarters, I'm aware, and just my one experience, I'm aware that that will cost me writing time.
Mm-hmm.
So at the moment, it's not worth it for me to take the time off of writing. Like, I was talking to Brad Bellew, excuse me, I just totally bobbled his last
Beaulieu.
Name. Beaulieu, yes.
Or no, Beaulieu.
Beaulieu. It's Beaulieu Socks Off.
Beaulieu Socks Off, exactly.
Yes. Brad Beaulieu, who's been a friend of mine since 2005. I can't believe that I just did that. But anyway, he said that when he did his Kickstarter, the amount of time it took to prep for it and do all of the fulfillment afterwards, he could have written another novel.
Yeah. And I'm going to tell you this also, Mary. People who listen to this show, they are so used to not having names pronounced correctly that at this point it's like a bad trope.
Then I should have lied to you about how to pronounce mine.
But the point that I was kind of getting to is I've even seen like podcasts do Kickstarters to fund a season.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of things going out there. I want to get to the reason that the 4 of you are here together talking about this. But before I do that, I want to go around, and I'll start with you, John, and then we'll go around in a circle here. What's like the worst mistake you've seen someone do that, you know, caused like a, in your opinion, caused a Kickstarter to fail?
I don't know in terms of when they're actually conducting the Kickstarter, what the failure is. I mean, probably in most cases it's, you know, just over promising on stretch goals, and they don't really factor in what what all those things are, what all those things are going to cost. But I mean, you know, you take a look at something like Clang, which just notably sort of crumbled after raising so many hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's just kind of astonishing that so much can go wrong, even when you have all that going for you, even when you have all that infrastructure in place. So I don't know. I think it'd be really hard to pinpoint any particular things, but and I haven't studied failed Kickstarters enough to tell you. I'm sure Matt or Toby probably could, because they do all that gaming and gaming out of scenarios and whatnot.
Well, I think you've got it. You've hit it on the head when you said, you know, asking for too much money, because I think, you know, someone coming out of nowhere and they've got, you know, maybe 200 people paying attention to them on social media, or, you know, followers on Twitter or something, and they're an author and they try to kickstart a novel, I think they're going to fail. But someone like Toby, who has an established career and has a following and people know what he's going to put out, you know, and they already love the series, I think it's a no-brainer, you know, for him to be able to do something like that. He's got the following behind him to help him push that forward. Mary, what about you?
Minions.
The one that I see is not understanding that they have to tell a story, that when you're trying to do fundraising, that it's all about trying to make people understand not just why the project is cool, but why the person who is funding you wants to commit their money to it. What it is that you have to tell them how they're going to be a hero in a lot of ways, because everyone sort of wants to be a hero. What it is about this, why it needs to exist in the world. And there's a narrative that you have to tell in order to get this across to people when you're doing any sort of fundraising. And I see a lot of people fail to explain what is unique and special about their Kickstarter, what makes it stand out.
Very cool. Toby?
Yeah, you know, I always say that there are three legs that you have to kind of stand on to make a Kickstarter work, which is, one, you have to have proof of prior delivery, which is why it's popular for authors with an existing career. We prove that we've written entertaining novels before. We prove that we can do them in a year or 2 years or however long our process is. So, you know, you have to have that proof you can deliver. You have to have a following. Like you said, you know, there's going to be a difference between someone with a couple hundred followers on Twitter versus someone with thousands. And then, as Mary said, you need to have that interesting concept or reason for people to want to fund you. And if you have those three things, or at least you need two of those three, you can get sort of a Kickstarter hit. I've looked at a lot of failed Kickstarters. I've seen some. I've seen people who've never actually delivered a project, you know, never actually written a novel at any given point, asking money for someone to write a novel. And you're, you know, as a potential clicker, you're thinking, why would I give you money when I've never seen you prove that you can deliver? It's one of the reasons why I actually, you know, I hope I don't get into trouble for saying this like public on a podcast, but I actually didn't back Clang. I saw it. I was like, yeah, it looks interesting, but I don't know if any of these guys have particularly actually shepherded a video game project to fruition before. Therefore, I will not give them my money. Sure. There's no proof of prior delivery. And that for me is a huge thing. They have a following, and yes, it was an interesting concept, but there was no number three for me. And I think as more people get further down the process of going through a few Kickstarter cycles, you know, they will start to also have that basic filter on as well.
Interesting. Matt, you can't say go read the blog.
Well, I let me comment on Clang. I think the other thing they did wrong there was that they didn't ask for enough money, right?
Right.
There was no way in hell they were going to be able to produce a game that required custom hardware for only $500,000, right? No way in hell. And they probably should have known this. And maybe they did know that, but they thought they're going to use this for seed money so they could go out and get other investors to figure out to actually complete the funding for it. And I think that's a mistake. I think that, you know, like we were talking about before, you should have it be so that this is, if I get this, I can deliver everything I'm talking about, as opposed to this is just the first step and we're going to do stretch goals from here. The other thing I see people screwing up all the time when they're just starting out doing this stuff is they see Kickstarter as like a store or a venue where people go and browse and shop for things they want to back. And that's almost never true. Most of the people Kickstarter is just this platform that allows you to stand up on top of a soapbox and yell, right? But you have to actually bring the people to that soapbox to let them listen to you. And if you don't bring them there, they're not going to just wander by. This is not you standing in the middle of a crowd yelling at people. You have to bring your crowd with you somehow, either tap into other people's crowds or have your own social media presence online or whatever else you need to do. But there are not just people sitting there waiting, browsing, combing Kickstarter for the cool new things. That actually happens out on Twitter and on Facebook and in Google Plus and everywhere else that people are coming together. And then they come over to Kickstarter after that.
Yeah, Kickstarter itself is a website. It does have the feature that if you follow somebody else on Kickstarter, it'll notify you when they back something, but you can't count on that. I mean, it's that would be the only way really for Kickstarter itself to let you know what's going on.
Yeah, and even then you have to be networked in pretty well to have that kind of a following or be following that kind of people, right? So if you just showed up and you've never done a Kickstarter before, you've never backed one before, and you don't know anybody else is doing this stuff, and yet you put this thing up there and just expect people to wander by out of nowhere. I mean, it's like setting up a lemonade stand on a deep in the woods, right? It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, you know, I'm listening to us and I'm thinking that actually the one thing that none of us have said kind of straight up, which is the biggest mistake, is people don't do their homework. Yeah. On any of this.
Yeah. That qualifies for almost all those, the comments.
Yeah.
So that brings us around to the main thing that we kind of wanted to talk about a little bit here. John, do you want to tell people what's going on?
Sure. So I just launched a Kickstarter today, the day that we're recording anyway, that this will be last week, I guess, by the time this airs, called Help Fund My Robot Army. And it's an anthology of improbable, futuristic, magical, and alternate world crowdfunding projects. So basically, I edit Lightspeed Magazine, and I had a story from Kathy Curley submitted to me, and it was called Help Fund My Robot Army, and it was told in the form of a Kickstarter pitch. And so when I was reading, it's basically like a mad scientist looking for funding to, you know, fund a robot army. And so I thought it was really funny. And when I got to the end of it, I was just like, man, like I could see a whole book of these. And so I emailed Kathy and I'm like, hey, would you be okay with me publishing in this in Lightspeed? I mean, of course, he's going to be okay with that. He submitted it to me. But I was like, is it okay if I publish this in Lightspeed? But then I also develop a project based around it and do an anthology of other stories set in, science fictional or fantastical Kickstarters. Because, I mean, really, like if you've looked at a lot of Kickstarters, I mean, the one thing that they all boringly have in common is that they abide by the physical laws of the universe, right? So, I mean, if you could have a Kickstarter that lets you do whatever you want, anything that, you know, that had no limits, like there was like anything you can imagine in a Kickstarter. I mean, why wouldn't you want to play around with that?
And everybody, Matt and Mary and Toby, they all have stories in this.
Correct.
That's right. Yep.
Mary, what was your Kickstarter starter in this, Mary?
I've pitched two to John, and we're kind of waiting to see which one I'm actually going to write, but I'll tell you what both of them are. And who knows, maybe if your podcasters can cast a vote on which one I do, then, I mean, not podcasters, your listening audience can cast a vote on which one I do. So the two are either Zero G Puppetry, funding a full-scale production of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet in airless space with puppet theater. Or Building Mr. Darcy. Through genetic manipulation, build the perfect Austin hero.
I'm sorry, but as someone who grew up in the 70s, sitting in front of the TV watching Sesame Street and The Muppet Show, all I heard was pigs in space.
My dear, this is Shakespeare
in space.
This is Shakespeare in space.
So I should point out for the listeners that, you know, these are all basically like Schrodinger short stories right now. They, you know, they sort of exist in theory, but they won't actually become realized in the real world until the Kickstarter funds. So
you, the listener, have to back it.
Exactly. Do your little NPR sort of pitch here, which is
you have to fund it. If you fund it, they will write it.
Yeah, except for Kefi's story. That one exists already, and that one is actually in the October issue of Lightspeed, which you can go read right now for free. You can also listen to it if you prefer to listen to the podcast produced by Stefan Rudnicki, the amazing audiobook producer.
And, that guy?
Yeah, yeah. So
I was on a panel with him. I mean, he was just incredibly nice. He was kind. I mean, everything I hate about a person, seriously.
But yeah, you know, I mean, like, this is like a project that I think is kind of like a lot of people, like, you tell it to them and they might think it's funny, but they don't really know that they're going to want to spend money on something like that, like a book of stories about that. So I thought it was really important to have that one story out there where people could go read it right now. And that way, you know, they can see the Kickstarter, they can pop over to Lightspeed and read Keffi's story. And then if they like it, then be like, oh yeah, no, I would totally read a whole anthology of stories like that. And, you know, and if they don't, then they won't back it, I guess. But hopefully there won't be too many of those people.
Toby, do you have something planned for it or written yet?
I don't have anything written, and John and I have not nailed down what I'm going to write. Like, I think we did have a couple exchanges about it way back when, and then seemed to have not followed up on it. I love how deliciously meta this project is. That's what attracted me to it.
Now, likewise. No offense to any of you, but if anyone has a chance of actually getting their Kickstarter inside the Kickstarter anthology funded, it's Matt.
he's already done super heroic levels of Kickstarterdom.
Yeah. Yes.
The crazy part is actually it's not the Kickstarters I've done, but I've actually been involved in like another 24 stretch goals for different people's Kickstarters, right? And it's gotten to the point where I've started to turn people down for it. And I was going to start turning people down. And I actually had started turning people down. And then John came to me with this one. I said, oh, for God's sake, I got to do this. I can't turn that down. It's too much fun, right?
And I want to say that I'm in the same thing with Matt, that I've started turning down Kickstarter anthologies and things like that. And the way John approaches it is different than a lot of the other people. The way John approaches it, I don't have to do any extra work. Like, someone approached me to do a Kickstarter and they said, you know, we're going to pay you 7 cents a word and we're going to ask you to pitch this to your... to all of your readers and promote us on Twitter and Tumblr and Facebook and listed all of this promotional stuff that they wanted me to do. I'm like, 7 cents a word gets me to write a story. You're asking me to also do your publicity for you. And while I'm like, you have to pay me more than that. And while I know that is a lot of what's going on with a Kickstarter, as you know, while you're being realistic about what it's going to cost to do the Kickstarter and get the things to your backers, you also have to be realistic about what it's going to cost the people or who are contributing stories. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, this is basically, you know, this is John's baby, and I am happy to have my story there, but he's treating me like a professional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and That's awesome. One of the things I wanted to be careful about was with this whole stretch goal problem, where you can promise too many stretch goals and then you end up getting into trouble by, you know, your cost basis sort of goes way down, and you know, you end up having to, or I may have used that term wrong, but you know what I mean. You end up spending too much on the stretch goals, and you don't actually make any money off the additional money you make, or the additional money you raise. But so for this one, what I wanted to do was we're asking for $6,000. As we're talking, we're at $1,800 already. But, you know, if we raise anything above and beyond our goal, I'm just going to share it with the contributors. That way, you know, like Mary's saying, you know, I don't want everyone to go out and do their do publicity for me. But, you know, if the thing starts doing well, then everyone can benefit equally. You know, so anybody that does actually help out and whatever, it's like, well, it actually is going to benefit you directly instead of just benefiting me. Like, instead of like, because like, I think a lot of anthologies, it would be like, oh, well, you know, you're going to get 7 cents a word. And if this book mega funds, like, you know, you raise like $100,000 or something, it's like, oh, that's all going in the editor's pocket or something, instead of being shared with the authors. And it doesn't seem fair.
That's like incentive and everything. Hell.
And yeah. John wonders why we love working with him.
Treats us professionals.
I'm sorry. The other thing that I've gotten a couple times is people who have asked me to be a part of anthologies and not indicated that it was going to be a Kickstarter or is a Kickstarter. And I've felt that that's really unprofessional. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's happened a few times. And I've been not for ones I've said yes to, but I've gone and poked around just out of curiosity and been like, wait a second, why would they hold that information back? That's not very cool.
Yeah, no, that's interesting.
They suck. Come on.
What were you gonna say, John?
I was just gonna say one of the most fun things. One of the most fun aspects of this process, I think I had during all this was, there was designing Keffy's story on Lightspeed, because like we did as much as we could to make it look like a Kickstarter page. So, you know, we got this art, like Galen Dara did the art, and, you know, she just won a Hugo this year. But so she did the art for us. And then, we mocked up the little pledge goal box that goes next to the image. And, you know, we put that on there, and it's like a failed project because that project's over already. And then, you know, we added some other little elements, and it's like, it's all like little tiny stuff that I don't even know how many people are actually going to notice. But like, it was important to me that when you look at the page on Lightspeed, it actually looks like it fits on Kickstarter. But then the other thing that I really had fun with, which I was dreading, was doing the video, because everyone always says, oh, you got to do a video. And I'm like, ugh, I don't want to do it. And like when I did Nightmare, we didn't do a video. We intended to, and we just never got around to it. And then it became too late. And it was like, okay, well, I guess we're not doing one. But then for this one, I was like, well, no, this is a Kickstarter. This is an anthology about Kickstarters. I can't like skimp out on one of the main aspects of a Kickstarter. And so I was like trying. I was trying to record myself. I tried getting my sister-in-law to record me and like, you know, acting as director, and just nothing was working. And then I had a thought. I was like, well, what if I could have something on screen that people can look at that isn't me talking, and I can just talk over that, right? And it's like, I can do that. I can record audio. I mean, because even if I screw it up, I can edit that together and make it sound great, right? And then so then the question became, well, what do I do? And then I think I came upon what is possibly my best idea related to this whole process. I exploited cats. Because the internet loves cats. And so we actually have a cat shelter here in Lompoc where I live. And so I went down there, I asked permission to record some video of the cats, and I just recorded a cat video. And so, you know, if you go watch my Kickstarter video, it's me talking, but then you're watching a bunch of adorable cats. And the other nice thing is that you can adopt all those cats. They're all up for adoption. So, I mean, if you happen to live in California and you need a cat, then, you know, you could actually watch the video and fall in love with a cat. And then you could back the shelter and then maybe back my project, too.
And is one of the rewards that you get a loving kitty?
You know, we've already adopted two cats from this particular shelter. And the last time we did, they actually gave us the wrong cat.
I read that.
And the cat they gave us actually tried to kill my wife. So that wasn't particularly cool. But once we found out that the right cat is actually still there, we're talking about possibly going and getting him. So I don't want to make him a stretch goal or anything, but I mean, we're probably getting that other cat. So
that whole story is online somewhere. You should go read it because it's hilarious, where Christy's like, I don't understand. The cat was so loving in the shelter, and then it tried to kill me.
Oh my goodness.
It's like a horror story, but with pets.
Now, John, I do need to apologize to you.
Oh, okay.
After the Hugos, I had a chat with Galen, and I said, you realize now that all your rates have to double.
That's all right. She's totally worth it.
She is. Absolutely.
Yes. She's amazing.
So any other, do you want to talk about any of the stretch goals or any of that kind of stuff, or what the reward levels are?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, like I mentioned with the stretch goals, I decided to just share everything above and beyond our goal with the authors. So we don't have stretch goals, but we have regular rewards. And actually, that was one of the things that was interesting for me when I was putting it together, is because, you know, this is a Kickstarter that I'm doing, but I'm also the publisher of Lightspeed. And so it's like kind of partially a Lightspeed Kickstarter as well, but not really. It's not because it's not public. It's not like Lightspeed Presents or anything. On the other hand, that the story did start with Lightspeed, and Keffy's story is being published in Lightspeed, so there's a lot of sort of crossover. But when I was doing the rewards, I did want to offer some things from Lightspeed, but I tossed and turned over the idea of having subscriptions in there. But and ultimately, I decided not to actually offer subscriptions, but I did offer bundles of back issues, because it's great to sell subscriptions, but I didn't want to like rob Lightspeed in order to pay for this, you know, because sure. Anytime we get a subscription to Lightspeed, I want that to be funding Lightspeed, not something else. And so it was tricky coming up with the right balance of rewards that are like great for the backers and then also are going to work for me and aren't going to have like sort of hidden costs that I'm not going to, you know, think about until it's too late. So basically, but you know, if you spend at least $10, you get a copy of the anthology. And we also throw in some other stuff, like you get a randomly selected ebook issue of one of my magazines, and you get a copy of the ebook of my anthology Seeds of Change. And you know, everyone's acknowledged for their support in the book, the way I have the rewards structured, unless you don't want to be, and in which case we won't. But and then we have a bunch of other other tiers, you know, so you can back a bundle of Nightmare issues, you can back a bundle of Lightspeed issues. There's signed copies of my anthologies. There's some Tuckerizations. We actually had two Tuckerizations that we made available today, and they all went really quickly. And I'm just going to sort of seed them throughout the Kickstarter as we go on here, because almost everybody who actually is writing stories for us actually said that they were willing to do a Tuckerization. And so I didn't want to like overload it all at once. So I'm just going to dole them out, you know, a couple at a time. And then I also do have some other sort of collectible type things. Like I have a couple of advanced review copies of my books. So some of the higher tier I have, you can buy those and I'll sign them and, you know, and you get a copy of the anthology as well, of course. But then there's also, I also have what I call the super fan reward and the ultra mega fan, which is just basically, it's like you get everything. So the super fan reward, the one person bought this already and there's only two available, but you get a signed personalized copy of all 16 of my anthologies that have been published to date. In hard copy, obviously, and then you get a copy of the anthology, and then the ultra mega fan, it gives you the super fan reward, plus you get both the bundle rewards, so you get like basically everything I've ever published as an editor.
But no weasels.
No weasels. No.
No.
This is
no,
weasel free.
No. Yes.
Unless Mary writes about weasels for her story.
There are no weasels in Romeo and Juliet.
Not in the real version.
Yes.
Well, fine. Yes.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
All right. Now, perfect. Speaking of respecting you guys and being professional, all that kind of stuff, we've run way over the time that I promised. So I'm going to go around and we'll let everybody have some final words on Kickstarters. And then John can tell everybody where they can go and find it. Let's start with you, Matt. Final thoughts.
What should I say?
any final thoughts? And what's your website and social media and all that kind of good stuff?
Sure. You can find me at Forbeck, Forbeck.com or M Forbeck on Twitter or Forbeck on Kickstarter or just about anywhere else. I'm always happy to talk to people. There are lots of great Kickstarters out there. I'm usually involved in like two or three at a time. So just come out there and see what we're doing. It's always a lot of fun.
Toby? Yep.
Yeah, check it out. It looks like a lot of fun, or we wouldn't be doing it, obviously, because we're all crazy busy. So it's always fun to work with John. And it's, you know, when has a John Joseph Adams project ever gone wrong? You can find me at www.tobiasbuckel.com. I'm on Twitter at Tobias Buckel, and I'm also on Kickstarter.
Very cool. Mary?
Now, I've already forgotten the question. I'm apparently very tired tonight.
any final thoughts on Kickstarter and what's your website, social media, and all that kind of good stuff?
So sorry. I'm in the middle of recording an audiobook, and apparently it's eaten my brain. Kickstarter is, I think, fantastic, not just as a way for creators to create content, but for people who are interested in content to find stuff that really is exactly what they're looking for. I back a fair number of things because I think it's very exciting. And on social media, you can find me at maryrobinettekowal.com. And I'm not going to spell that because it will probably be in the liner notes. And my Twitter is maryrobinette, first and middle names.
She gives me so much credit. John?
As we were saying earlier, the project is called Help Fund My Robot Army and Other Improbable Kickstarters. I created a redirect on my website so I can tell you the URL easily without having to list your long string of gibberish. So if you just go to johnjosephadams.com/Kickstarter, that'll take you to the Kickstarter page. And like I said, you spend $10, you get a copy of the book, and you get all kinds of awesome made-up Kickstarters. And you can watch a sweet cat video if you like. And if you want to follow me for other stuff, you go to johnjosephadams.com, go to John Joseph Adams on Twitter, Facebook, Kickstarter, all kinds of stuff. Anything, I'm every John Joseph Adams, basically. So any network, that's me.
Very cool. Well, I want to thank all of you for coming on tonight. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I want to remind you that the Raiders suck.
Yes. Thank you for that reminder. I had forgotten.
Is that a table tennis team?
Something like that. It's foosball. Okay. It's foosball.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yes. So anyway, thanks for coming on. Everybody should go check out the Kickstarter. And you guys all have a great evening.
Thanks. All right. You too.
Thanks, you too.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for listening to the SF Signal podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. To comment about this or any of our podcast episodes, please call our voicemail line at 720-277-9082. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo?
Wah, wah.
And scene.